High buildings swarfed her on all sides. She checked the street, but she felt safe among the garish throngs of Saturday night partiers. Her condo on O'Farrell was only 5 blocks away. She heard the chime of her phone again, ping. He wasn't giving up. Frankie hesitated. No matter how much she wanted to pull away, she found herself going deeper into this man's game. She had no choice. She opened the message. 5 minutes. This time there was something more to the email. She saw an attachment file, a JPEG picture. He'd sent her a photograph. Do not respond. Never open attachments. But she did. She clicked on the image, wondering if she'd made a mistake that would give him access to her whole electronic life. But it felt as if he knew everything about her already, where she was, what she was doing. Frankie stared at the photo on the small screen of her phone. It had been taken from above, like a still image captured from a ceiling-mounted webcam. The photo showed the inside of a busy cocktail lounge, people crowded shoulder to shoulder in the semi-darkness. The bar glowed with red and green lights, reflecting on dozens of liquor bottles stocked on mirrored shelves. She squinted and saw something else, too. 3 vintage pinball machines from the 80s. She knew where this place was. It was a bar, 2 blocks away. She and Jason had been there many times. Loud pop music, drinks, dancing. Frankie checked the time. It was 5 minutes to midnight. 5 minutes. She didn't understand why this photograph was supposed to mean anything to her, but then she remembered, she needs you. With a pinch of her fingers, she enlarged the image and scrolled from face to face. No one was looking at the camera. No one knew they were being photographed. She didn't see anyone she recognized. The faces were all strangers, except... Frankie felt the breath leave her chest. She zoomed in on one face until the image began to lose its focus. And then she realized that she knew this woman. Her name was Christy Park. She was 37 years old. She lived in Millbrae and worked as a loan officer at a branch of Wells Fargo downtown. 5 years ago, while volunteering at a homeless shelter, she'd been stuck with a dirty needle and diagnosed with AIDS. The lab result turned out to be a false positive. She was fine, but the experience had left her with a deadly fear of needles. It was a fear that Frankie had helped her erase. Christy was one of her patients. Frankie stared at the steep Mason Street hill that led up toward the bar. She started running. 16. Christy watched as her date, whose name was Noah, pushed the pinball flippers, firing a silver ball straight up the super jackpot ramp and making the eyes of the Terminator's skull glow red.
"Filed will,"
said the voice of Arnold Schwarzenegger from the game's display. After a quick fist pump, Noah used a rotating gun to shoot a new ball into play. He juggled 3 balls up and down the machine, and Christy couldn't keep track of the action. Arrows lit up, bumpers flashed and exploded. The machine rocked as Noah slammed it with his hips.
"Awesome,"
Arnold said.
"Awesome,"
Noah imitated in a deep voice. He glanced at Christy, whose boredom must have shown on her face. 30-something men playing teenage games didn't thrill her, especially on a first date. With obvious reluctance, Noah took his hands off the flippers, and one by one the silver balls rolled into the belly of the machine. He gave her an embarrassed smile. "Sorry," he told her. "I used to play this game when I was a kid. I just wanted to see if I still had the knack." "I guess you do," Christy said coolly, sipping her cranberry martini. There was a line to take Noah's spot at the pinball machine. They were all men who weren't getting laid tonight, Christy figured. That included Noah. She'd decided that soon after she met him for dinner. He was nice enough, but he acted like a kid, and she wasn't interested in kids. "I'm going to get another beer," Noah told her. "You want anything?" "No, I'm good." He jostled his way through the crowd, leaving her alone. He saw other guys give her the eye, wondering whether to come in for a landing. A few smiled, and she smiled back, but not enough for an invitation. Christy liked being in demand. After her divorce last November, she'd lost 20 pounds, and she looked good in her shorty skirts again. Dating was a hassle in her 30s, but for now she enjoyed being single. She'd hooked up a couple of times, and it was strange to be the one to say, "I'll call you," when she knew she never would. She was happy to head to work the next morning with a satisfied smile on her face. No walk of shame, just the coffee cup of freedom. Christy liked the vibe of the Bush Street Bar, despite the juvenile pinball machines. It felt like a throwback to the 90s. Most of the people were her own age, not the usual millennials. A jukebox played Aerosmith at a shattering volume. The drunk Gen Xers danced fast, as if they were still young, but she knew they'd wake up, roll out of bed, and groan at the ache in their knees. It was warm near the bar's fireplace, and she felt heat on the back of her legs. Perfume, cologne, and hair gels clouded the air. The effect was dizzying, but she couldn't really blame the bar. She'd felt off all day. She'd awakened with an odd sense of disorientation, as if she didn't even belong in her own apartment. Since then, she'd been up and down in huge swings. One minute she would be euphoric, and the next she'd feel a formless anxiety grip her stomach. Her brain kept trying to remember something, but nothing was there. Noah came back, holding a bottle of amber IPA. He wore a black sport coat over a red T-shirt and blue jeans and sneakers, which was how 36-year-olds tried to shave a decade off their age. He was a few donuts shy of being overweight. He had messy red hair and a goatee, as if he'd spotted a photograph of Ed Sheeran in People and decided that was the way to meet girls. Christy could have told him that the red beard pirate look only worked for Ed Sheeran because he was Ed Sheeran. She'd been set up on a blind date by one of her colleagues at the bank. She should have been firmer in saying no. "You having fun?" Noah asked. "Sure," she replied without enthusiasm. He didn't seem to notice, so she checked her watch to make her point. She wasn't looking to prolong the evening. It was almost midnight, and her date was already a pumpkin. "You know, I thought you were going to blow me off," he said. "Oh? I texted you like 4 times yesterday, but you didn't answer." "Sorry, I slept the whole day. I guess I wasn't feeling well." "Was it a cold or something? I take a crap load of vitamin C every day, and I never get colds." "No, I don't know what it was," Christy said. "Maybe some kind of 24-hour bug. I crashed out and lost the whole day." "Are you feeling better now?" "A little, but I don't want to make it a late night." Noah still didn't take the hint. The music on the jukebox changed from Aerosmith to the B-52s, and his freckled face brightened into a grin. "Hey, great song," he said. "Come on, let's dance." "No, I don't really feel up to it," she began. But he didn't take no for an answer. He took her wrist and pulled her through the crowd to the postage stamp dance floor. Most of the dancers were drunk. Noah writhed to Love Shack, and she was pleasantly surprised to find that he followed the beat like a pro. His supple moves made him much more attractive than he'd been a minute earlier. He knew it, and his confidence glowed in his face. Christy loosened up as she danced with him. Some of her energy came back. She wasn't a great dancer herself, but she didn't care. She forgot about the anxiety that had dogged her all day. Noah pointed at her smile and called over the music, "See? You're having fun!" She gave him a thumbs up. He was right. The B-52s became the Go-Go's, and the Go-Go's gave way to Donna Summer. He laughed as she lip-synced to Bad Girls. When the song was over, Noah put a meaty arm around her shoulder, and she left it there. They were both breathing hard. She looked up into his blue eyes and wondered if she'd judged him too quickly. Suddenly, he did look a little like Ed Sheeran. "I love this place," he said. "Yeah, it's great." "How about that next drink now?" he asked. "Okay, sure." "Crantini?" "Yeah, thanks." She watched him go, and he had a swagger in his step as he headed toward the bar. It was cute now. She tugged at the collar of her blouse because she was hot from dancing. She fluffed out her hair with her hands. Overhead, the music changed, something mellow this time, a Carole King song. Somebody at the pinball machine whooped in excitement, and Arnold Schwarzenegger called out,
"Awesome!"
Christy laughed. Frankie took off her heels to run faster, but she was too late. Midnight came and went. Half a block down the sharp hill from the cocktail lounge, she heard a scream that was more animal than human. It rose and fell, cutting through her brain like a knife. It was the scream you made when you saw hell. It was the scream you made when you were on fire. A door slammed, shouts overlapped, warnings, cries. Ahead of her, a truck flew down Mason Street into the green light. As it did, a woman ran into the intersection, her hands over her face, not even seeing the danger. The truck's horn blared in a wild, continuous roll. Brakes screeched, and tires burned black skids onto the pavement. There was no time to stop. Frankie turned away in horror, but she heard the sickening thump of metal and body colliding. Not 10 feet in front of her, the woman's broken form tumbled down the hill and lay still. Frankie smelled the stench of hot rubber. Headlights and shadows crisscrossed the intersection. Footsteps pounded. She couldn't see the face of the woman in the road, but she already knew who it was. The dead woman in the street was her patient, Christy Park. The night bird had killed her. 17. The night bird, Frost said. He watched Francesca Stein stare at the accident scene. The evening was cool, and she wore his sport coat draped over her shoulders. Yes, that's right, she said. That's the name he uses in his messages. And you think this person is somehow programming these women? She disconnected her cell phone from its portable charger and handed it to him. You can see the emails he sent. He knew Christy was going to have her breakdown at midnight. He wanted me to see it happen. Frost studied the messages on Stein's phone. He enlarged the photograph that had been taken inside the bar, but there was nothing in Christy Park's face to suggest what was about to happen to her. Just like Monica Farr, just like Bryn Lansing. The police had closed the intersection. The medical examiner was processing the body. The truck that had struck and killed Christy Park was still parked in the middle of the street, with blood on its dented grill. He saw a uniformed officer taking a statement from the driver, but there was nothing the man could have done to avoid the collision. Pedestrians gawked from behind the police tape, and neighbors stood in the lit windows of the apartment buildings that overlooked the scene. The media had arrived, too. He spotted video cameras from the local news channels. Stein's face pinched into a frown. She saw the cameras, too. Her name would be on television again. It was never good news that made the headlines. How is he doing this? Frost asked. How does it work? I don't know. Frost handed her the phone. Can you forward these emails to me? Of course, but I'm not sure it will help you. I asked a private security company to examine the messages, and they weren't able to trace them. We have our own experts, Frost said. And if you get any more, you'll be the first to know, Inspector, Stein replied. Her face was a chaos of emotions. She was distracted, confused, afraid, upset. Her eyes kept going back to the street, as if the moment of the accident were replaying in her mind. The impact, the noise. Once you saw someone die, you were never the same. A body always left its mark. Katie had been his first. Wind blew down the street and whisked strands of her short brown hair into her face, but she didn't seem to notice. She leaned her head back against the stone wall of the building behind her and closed her eyes. The downward turn of her lips was eloquent in its sadness. "He's taunting you, and he's targeting your patients," Frost said. "This is obviously personal." "Obviously," she murmured. "Do you have any idea who could be doing this?" Her eyes opened. She stared, not at him, but past him. She was hiding something. "I can't tell you anything. I'm sorry." "Because you don't know anything, or because this involves your patients?" The psychiatrist was silent. "Privilege doesn't apply if you know a patient represents a serious risk of harm to others," Frost added. "I'm well aware of my legal responsibilities, Inspector." "Then can you tell me why someone would be doing this?" "To destroy me," she replied. "You think that's what this is about?" Her eyes were hard. "Yes, I do." "Has this person made any threats against you?" Frost asked. "He said he's going to watch me die. Does that count?" "I wish you'd told me about that when it happened," he said. "I've been threatened before, Inspector, and the police are no help. Sorry, but that's a reality. The law guards the victimizers, not the victims." "You're preaching to the choir," Frost replied. He added, if you wanted to do this to someone, make them behave in an extreme, erratic way, could you do it? It would depend on the person, but yes. How? A combination of drugs and hypnotic suggestion? Like in your memory practice? He asked. Yes. So someone who went through your treatment would know how the process works? I suppose so, she said. Her voice was flat, drained of intensity. What kind of drugs do you use? That depends on the patient. A sedative like amobarbital would be a common choice. Sadly, no one would have much trouble putting their hands on it on the street. So the drugs loosen the brain's control, and hypnosis provides the direction? Basically. Don't you find that scary? Frost asked. Anything is scary when it's misused, she replied. Okay, true. Do you need anything else from me right now, Inspector? I'd like to go home. One more question. What did you treat Christie Park for? What was her problem? Stein didn't answer immediately, but then she said, needles. She was afraid of needles. Terrified. Frost nodded. He watched her eye the crowds, and he said, let me have someone drive you home, Dr. Stein. You don't want to run the gauntlet. Thank you. Stein slipped his sport coat off her shoulders and handed it back to him with a weary smile. She had a precise, elegant way about her. Her movements were graceful, and yet she kept a mysterious distance, as if she invited no one else inside. Frost often chose to be alone, but he enjoyed a solitude when he could get it. Francesca Stein's aloneness looked like melancholy. He signaled a policewoman, who accompanied Stein to a squad car. She took a last look at the crime scene before climbing inside. Frost tried to read her mind, and he guessed that she was thinking that her life would never be the same after this night. Murder was a before and after moment. He knew what that felt like. Christie's date, Noah, hummed incessantly. The same chorus of the same song, over and over. Frost found it distracting, but every witness had a different kind of nervous tic. The red-headed man sat on the floor of the lounge, with his back against the pinball machine and his hands wrapped around his knees. They'd already interviewed and dismissed the other patrons from the bar, but Frost wanted to talk to Noah himself. Frost stood over him. Noah's head bowed as he hummed, and he wore an awkward, inappropriate smile. He had a boyish face, naturally, and fear made him look even younger. "Thanks for sticking around," Frost said. "Oh, yeah, sure," he added. "So is she... I mean, did she..." "She didn't make it. Sorry." "Wow. I mean, I didn't really know her, but still... Wow. That's awful." "So exactly what happened, Noah?" "Hell if I know. I went to get her a drink, cranberry martini. It was her second. When I got back, she was shaking, screaming, covering her eyes. Then she ran out into the street, and bam, that was it." "Was she behaving strangely during the evening?" "No. If anything, she looked bored. Most of the night we didn't really click, you know." He started humming again, same song. It was like an earworm on an infinite loop. "Did you slip her anything?" Frost asked. His mouth fell open. "No, no, that's not my style. No way." "What about Christie? Did she take anything? Prescription or otherwise?" "Not that I saw," Noah said. "Where were you before you came to the bar?" he asked. "I took her to dinner at a Japanese place a couple blocks up Bush Street. I'm not much into sushi, but she said she liked it. Always give the lady what she wants on a first date." "Whose idea was it to come here afterward?" "Hers. I said, how about we get a drink, and she suggested this place." "Had she been here before?" Noah shrugged. "I don't know. She didn't say." "Did Christie talk to anyone else while you guys were together? Or did anyone talk to her? Did you see anyone who seemed to be watching her?" Noah hummed again, louder, as he thought about the evening. Then he shook his head. "I don't think so." "Are you sure?" "Well, Christie was cute. Short skirt, guys go for that. I saw other dudes checking her out. I got the feeling she liked the attention, you know? Pissed me off a little. After all, I was the one paying for dinner and buying the drinks." "Was there anyone in particular that she noticed, or who noticed her?" "Not that I remember. Sorry." Did Christy talk to you about having been in therapy? Frost asked. Noah grinned. What, like seeing a shrink? No, most girls are smart enough to keep the cray-cray hidden when you start dating them. Comes out sooner or later, though. Frost slid out a card and handed it to Noah. I think that's all for now. I can get out of here? He asked. Yes. If you think of anything else, my number's on the card. Frost headed for the door of the bar, but as he did, he found that he was whistling under his breath. He was on the street and into the third replay of the chorus before he realized that Noah's earworm had gotten inside his own head. He was whistling the same song that Noah had been humming. And once a song got into your brain like that, it was impossible to get it out. Then Frost realized something strange. The earworm stuck in his head wasn't new. He'd been whistling a fragment of a song wherever he went for the past couple of days. It popped onto his lips and demanded to come out. Noah had been humming the same song that Frost had been whistling for days. He went back inside the lounge and nearly bumped into Noah, who was on his way out of the bar. What are you humming? Frost asked. Huh? Oh, yeah, I do that. I know it can be irritating. Most of the time, I don't even know I'm doing it. Women have to tell me to stop. What's the song? Noah listened to the tune on his lips. I think it's a Carole King song. It was playing when Christy did her freak out. I guess it kind of stuck with me, you know? Noah was right. It was a Carole King song. Frost had heard it before, recently, over and over. Which one? He asked, even though he knew the answer. It's called Nightingale, Noah replied. I always liked that one. It's a song for lonely people, you know? It's about the nightbird winging his way home. 18. In her dream, Frankie hiked along the Point Reyes beach with her father beside her. He took long, determined steps in the sand, and she had to walk fast to keep pace with him. His back was as straight as a light post. His wiry hair defied the wind. He walked the way old men did, with his hands laced behind him. He fired questions at her, like an impatient professor. Question, Marvin said. Is there a formula for measuring acceptable risk? She was practically running. No. Question. Then how do you assess whether a risk is worth taking? It's a judgment call, she said, panting. You have to look at the circumstances in each case. Question. Is it acceptable to pursue your own selfish satisfaction when it causes risk to someone else? Slow down, she wanted to say. Slow down. I suppose it's a trade-off. How badly do you want something, and how big is the risk? Question. So it's okay to risk another's life or happiness simply because you really want something? That's not what I said. Question. Are you and Jason still sleeping together? Frankie stopped. What? How dare you ask me something like that? What does that have to do with anything? It's none of your business. Marvin kept walking, leaving her behind. He seemed taller than he was in real life. Frankie's senses felt oddly sharp. The noise of the waves was crisp and unnaturally loud, making her want to cover her ears. The beach was littered with hundreds of dead fish, their carcasses swarmed by flies, and rotting flesh squished under her bare toes. A briny smell filled her nose. Everything in the world felt bigger, brighter, and more intense. The ocean, the huge rocky cliffs climbing to the sky, her father striding ahead of her. It was like a movie playing in her head. She caught up with him. His voice was softer now. Was I a good father? He asked her. She shook her head. No. You're successful. Not because of you. Did I praise you enough? No. I need you, her father said. She cocked her head. What? You have 10 minutes to save me. What? She blinked, and her father was suddenly gone. She stood alone on the beach. The wind and waves grew more ferocious, as if she were in the center of a storm. Dead fish washed in with each slap of the tide. Spray soaked her skin. She looked all around to find her father. And then she saw him, a silhouette high on the tall cliff, his arms spread wide. He was going to jump. Stop! Frankie shouted, but the noise drowned her voice. She ran, but the wet sand sucked her down. He flew. Gravity brought him shooting toward her, larger and faster with each second. She turned away in horror, but she heard the sickening thump of flesh and rock colliding. Not 10 feet in front of her, when she looked again, her father's broken form cartwheeled down the beach and lay still. She stood over him. His limbs were twisted. Blood striped his face. His eyes snapped open. They were not human eyes under his eyelids. They were fly eyes, bug eyes. His lips grew into a giant, red-lipped grin from ear to ear. He sang to her in a horrible falsetto, "Frankie! Frankie!" She bolted upward in bed, screaming. Her body under her nightgown was clammy with sweat, and she threw off the covers. Warm sunlight streamed through the windows of her bedroom. She shook herself to drive the dream out of her brain, but the memory lingered, making her shiver. She got out of bed. Below her in the condo, she smelled coffee brewing. It was Sunday morning. She refreshed herself with a long shower. The pulse of the water massaged her back, and she breathed in steam. When she was done and out of the bathroom, she'd almost forgotten the dream. Then the creepy, falsetto voice came back. This time it was real, calling to her from inside her own bedroom. "Frankie! Frankie!" She screamed and spun around, but she was alone. The voice was coming from the phone on her nightstand. Someone was calling her, but somehow her ringtone had been changed. She ran to the phone, but she was too late to grab the incoming call. She fumbled with the buttons on the phone to check her settings, and when she found the listing of ringtones, she saw a new one. 0001, Nightbird. Frankie threw the phone against the wall where it shattered into pieces. How? How had he done it? She always had her phone with her. She never left it anywhere. But as if to taunt her further, the phone rang again. Not the broken phone on the floor. This was another phone, using her ordinary ringtone. The noise was muffled. She looked everywhere and realized that her own phone was still in her purse, her real phone. Somehow he'd slipped a second phone into her bag, as if to say, "I was this close to you once. I can be this close to you again." He was worming his way into her life, into her brain. She remembered sitting next to Todd Ferris on the bench the previous day. Was it him? Or had the Nightbird been among the crowd at Zingari again? Frankie dove into her purse and answered her phone. She didn't recognize the incoming number. "Dr. Stein?" "Yes, who is this?" "It's Christine Smith with the San Francisco Chronicle. I wanted to see if you had any comment about the unusual deaths of three of your patients." Frankie's fist tightened around the phone. The news was out. Soon she'd be under siege. "No, I don't have any comment right now. Should your patients be worried, do you have any idea how this could be happening?" "I can't talk to you right now, Miss Smith," Frankie said. She hung up the phone. Almost immediately it rang again. She didn't answer. She knew it would be another reporter. The vultures were gathering. She powered down her phone and returned it to her purse. She felt deja vu. This was how it had started with Darren Newman, too. Her life was spinning out of control. Frankie went downstairs. She poured coffee from the pot and took it out to the solarium. Pam was there, reading the newspaper on her iPad, and she didn't look up as Frankie took the chair next to her. A cool distance blew between them. "Hey," Frankie said. "Hey, yourself." "Where's Jason?" "Running." Pam's head swiveled. Her blonde hair was casually messy. Her long, bare legs were propped on a second chair. "Looks like you're famous again. It's on TV. It's in the paper." "I know." "Did you screw up? Give somebody the wrong meds?" "It's not me. Someone else is doing this." Pam sipped coffee. "What do you mean?" "Some psycho is targeting my patients and me." "Are you sure?" "I'm sure." "I thought I heard you shout earlier. Did something happen?" "Just a bad dream," Frankie said. After a pause, she added, "The dream was about Dad, actually." "Sounds like a nightmare." "It was. Remember how he used to ask us all those questions on our camping trips? Oh, Lord, Pam groaned. She lowered her voice to imitate their father. Question, does addiction constitute a brain illness or an absence of will? Question, does the intervention of family help or hurt in an addict's trajectory of dependence? Like I didn't know he was talking about me. His questions were always designed to remind me that I was a shithole failure in his eyes. Frankie knew Pam was right about that. Marvin's questions usually had a sharp edge, and the edge was always directed at Pam. Hey, you lucked out when the topic was extraplanetary life. There wasn't much he could do with that. I don't know. I kept waiting for him to say, question, if humans were relocated to another planet, would Pam be a minimum wage waitress or a whore? He wasn't quite that bad. He was every bit that bad, Frankie, Pam replied. Just like that, the shadow was back between them. Even from the grave, their father drove the two of them apart. I dreamed that I saw him on the cliff, Frankie said. Lucky you. He didn't fall. He jumped, in my dream. Maybe he did. Pam, don't say that, Frankie chided her. You said the rangers couldn't be sure. If he slipped or if he jumped, what difference does it make to us? In the end, it's the same. He's gone. And you know what? I don't miss him. Frankie hesitated. Neither do I. Okay, then, Pam said. Let's leave the bastard behind instead of talking about him every time we're together. Sorry. It still haunts me. Frankie got up. She wasn't done with her coffee, but she wanted to get to the office. She always felt safe in her office. That was where her life made sense. Plus, she was sure she had messages waiting for her. Patients would be watching the news, and they'd be scared. Do you think I'm a bad person? She asked. Pam's eyes had the sharpness of knives. I asked you that once myself, remember? I OD'd and nearly died. I was in rehab for the second time. Dad wouldn't even come to see me. I was crying because I needed a father, but I didn't have one. And I asked you if I was a bad person. Frankie closed her eyes. I do remember. You told me there was no such thing as bad people, Pam went on. Only bad memories. 19. Frost played the song for Lucy. She sat across from him on a bench in the Somal Market on Sunday morning. Shaq licked crepe syrup from her finger through the door of his carrier. The market was loud with the roar of cars and the elevated ramp of Highway 101 behind them. The stone wall of a parking lot across the street looked like a prison. The appeal of the market was its food, not its ambience. He increased the volume and put his phone between them. Carole King began singing. The song was Nightingale. "Do you recognize it?" he asked her. "Sure, I know the song." Lucy nodded along with the music. But then her face clouded with unease as a memory came back. Her lips pressed tightly together. She closed her eyes. He could hear the raggedness of her breathing. "Wait, that was the song on the radio that night," she said. "It was playing when Bryn..." Frost nodded. "I'm sorry. I figured it was, but I needed to be sure." "What does that matter?" Lucy asked. He took his phone back and found the video of the wedding where Monica Farr shot herself. He played the video for Lucy. Not as far as the chaos and the shooting, but far enough to hear the screaming begin in the background. The DJ at the wedding was playing the same song. "Oh, my God," Lucy said. "The same thing happened in a bar in the Tenderloin last night," Frost continued. "The same song was playing. Another woman had a mental breakdown. She ran into the street and was killed." Lucy pushed away his phone, as if it had become hot to the touch. "This is creepy as hell." "I know." They were silent for a while, eating Duane's crepes. He could see his brother at the window of his food truck, a line of 2 dozen people packed up at the truck, waiting for Duane's famous Sunday morning banana granola crepes with sweet hoisin maple syrup. Lucy spotted Duane, too, and she held up the crepe and shouted, "This is amazing!" Frost's brother took a little bow with his hands folded across the chest of his white chef's uniform. The customers around him applauded. "You and your brother don't look much alike," Lucy said to Frost. "You don't think so?" Funny, most people pick us out as brothers right away. But I agree with you. I don't see it. After all, I'm much more handsome than he is. Lucy grinned. Well, you're right about that. Now, Katie and I, we were practically twins, Frost went on. Do you have a picture of her? Frost slid his phone across the bench to Lucy. He reached over and tapped the digits to unlock it so she could see the photo of him and Katie that he used as his screensaver. The picture showed the two of them at Alcatraz on a perfect summer day, with the city and the bay waters behind them, and an endless California sky overhead. Her hair was sunny blonde. Her head leaned into his shoulder. "Wow, she was pretty," Lucy said. "And yes, you two definitely could have been twins. Thanks." Shaq nudged the door of the carrier with his paw, demanding more syrup, and Lucy obliged. She dabbed a little on his pink nose, and Shaq used his tongue to clean it. Frost found himself staring at Lucy, and he knew she was aware of his eyes. Her cheeks blushed red. She had a shy contentment in her face, looking back at him and then looking away. He knew the signs when a relationship with a stranger was on the brink of becoming something deeper. Her glow sent him a romantic invitation. Come get me. What Frost couldn't tell her was that he felt a completely different emotion when he was with her. He missed his baby sister. Something about being with Lucy made Katie feel not so far away. There's a reason I wanted you to know about the song, he said. Lucy sighed as he steered their conversation away from personal things. To scare the crap out of me? Sort of, yes. These incidents didn't happen by accident. The jukebox in the bar last night is controlled by a phone app, and someone hacked the app to play that song. I called the DJ who did the music at the wedding where Monica Farr died. He said someone in the crowd requested Nightingale. What about Bryn on the bridge? Lucy asked. Someone posted a request for the song on the radio station's Facebook page. Take a look. He'd saved the post on his phone, and he showed it to Lucy. Her smooth forehead crinkled as she spotted the name of the user behind the post. The Nightbird? She asked. That's right. Does the name mean anything to you? Have you heard it before? No, never. What does this mean, Frost? It means that what happened to Bryn and these other women was murder. Someone targeted them. Now you really are scaring me, Lucy said. I'm sorry, but that's the point. Remember what we talked about yesterday, about you going to see Francesca Stein. I don't want you to do it. Not now. That's why I asked you to meet me. I think you should cancel your appointment. Lucy thought about it, but then she shook her head. It's just to find out more. I'm not going to do anything yet. It's too dangerous, Lucy, at least right now. I understand what you're saying, but you know what? I'm sick of being afraid. I'm sick of what happens to me when I try to cross a bridge. Dr. Stein helped Bryn. She really did. So I'd like to find out whether she thinks she can help me, too. If you do this, I want to be waiting outside the building. Lucy giggled. My hero. I'm serious. I want to make sure no one is watching you when you leave. Okay, fine. If that's what you want, it is. And keep your eyes open. If you see anything that looks weird, you call me right away. Got it? She saluted him. Got it. I have to go, he told her. Yeah, I need to get to work, too. Thanks for breakfast. He gestured at the food truck behind her and waved to his brother. Thank Dwayne. If it were up to me, we'd be eating Cap'n Crunch. Well, I love Cap'n Crunch, too, Lucy said. She stood up and reached a finger into Shaq's carrier to say goodbye. The cat licked her fingertip. Frost stood up, too, and walked around the bench to be next to her. Their faces were close. Before he could stop her, she leaned quickly toward him and grazed his lips with her own. Her mouth had the sweetness of syrup. I just wanted to put that out there, she said. For what it's worth. Lucy, he murmured, in a tone of voice that meant disappointment for someone on the other side of a kiss. It's okay. You don't have to say anything. With a fragile smile and a shake of her brown hair, she was gone. He could still taste her. No matter how wrong it was, he couldn't pretend that he didn't enjoy the kiss, but he also knew that she was looking for something that he couldn't give her. She was sweet and lonely, and she was misreading the signs from him. Or maybe he was accidentally sending the wrong signals. Duane saw the kiss, too. From the food truck, his brother called something crude, and Frost shook his head as if to say, "It's not what you think." He shouted out a goodbye and grabbed Shaq's carrier. He pushed through the crowd toward 11th Street, but he stopped when a text tone chimed on his phone. He set the carrier between his ankles and grabbed his phone from his belt. The number was unfamiliar. He read the message, and he realized that the game had gone to a new level. "Hello, Inspector Easton. What's your worst memory?" 20. Frankie was right about her patients. They'd seen the news, and they were scared. When she got to her office, she found messages from 6 patients who'd canceled all their future appointments. 10 others wanted to know whether it was safe to see her. She spent 2 hours on the phone, reaching out to all of them, but it was hard to offer answers when she didn't know what was going on. Finally, she put down the phone and wandered into her treatment room, which was her oasis. One wall was devoted to books. On quiet weekend days, she would come here to read. She activated the surround sound speakers and played the noise of a rainstorm, with the plink-plink of showers and a distant turbulence of thunder. She turned on a video of Fern Canyon. It was at the end of a trail in Prairie Creek State Park that she and Jason had hiked on their honeymoon, where the narrow riverbed was lined by vertical stone walls dense with green ferns. Life had felt good then. She stretched out in the chaise that her patients used. She tried to read more of The Magus by Foles. The novel was about a young, self-centered teacher in Greece, facing erotic manipulation by 2 sisters and a mysterious magician. She'd read it before. Some days she felt as if she were the Magus herself, the manipulator, using dreams and drugs. But she was the one being manipulated now, and the plot felt too close to the reality of her world. She put the book down. When she glanced at the doorway, she saw Jason watching her. She hadn't heard him enter the office. His thumb and forefinger stroked his chin, which was unshaved. He wasn't smiling. Fern Canyon played on the screen, and the rain fell, which it had done on that long hike together. There had been a real chemistry between them on that trip. It felt like a long time ago. "You heard what's going on?" Frankie said. "Yes. I canceled my appointments this week, at least until the police catch this guy. I'm calling everyone else to warn them to be careful." "I suppose that's a good idea," Jason said. He sat down next to the chaise in the chair she usually used as a therapist. It was strange having him there, as if he were the doctor and she were the patient. Somehow it took away her power, and she didn't like it. She got up. She switched off the music and video. The treatment room, with its sound-baffled walls, was as silent as a crypt. "Do you think the person who's doing this is one of your patients?" Jason asked. "I don't know. The fact that he seems to be manipulating their behavior with some kind of hypnotic programming makes me think he must have seen my techniques up close, but he could have simply read up on me in the psychology journals, too. A lot of people think I'm evil. They'd love to hurt me." "Don't exaggerate, Frankie." "I'm not. I don't show you the mail I get." She'd testified in many lawsuits about the unreliability of recovered memories, even among people who believed they were victims of abuse. She'd also testified in criminal court about the problems of eyewitness identification, and thanks to her, accused murderers had been acquitted. She'd made a lot of money as an expert witness, and she'd made a lot of enemies, too. Nothing she said in court was false, but that didn't matter to people who felt robbed of justice. "If it's a patient, you know who's got my vote," Jason said. She did. "Darren Newman?" "That's right." Frankie walked to her bookshelves and ran a hand along the spines of the hardcovers. She looked back at the empty chaise. It was easy to picture Darren Newman there, talking about his Midwest childhood, almost dying in a collapsed snow fort, being lured into bed by his math teacher. He was singularly handsome and charming, a man who was nearly impossible to resist. She'd never met a better liar. "Why would Darren do that?" she asked, her voice soft. "He already got what he wanted. He fooled me. He's free because of me, and Marilyn Summers is dead." "Why does a sociopath do anything? Look at this guy's behavior. The taunting, the secret identity, the game playing, the risk-taking. That's exactly who Darren is. He was right, but she knew there was an extra reason why Jason believed in Darren Newman's guilt. He blamed him for the state of their marriage, and he wasn't entirely wrong. The revelations about Darren Newman and the murder of Marilyn Summers had shaken Frankie to her core. She'd grown distracted, out of touch, withdrawn. She'd become emotionally unreachable, and the emptiness had made its way into their bedroom. They'd gone months without making love. Jason hadn't made things better. Another man might have tried to crack her shell and draw her back to him. Jason didn't. He buried himself in his lab and waited for her to fix herself. She'd never really been the same since then. There was still a canyon between them. She'd never told Jason about the pass that Darren made at her. Patients did that from time to time. Usually the attachment was just a side effect of therapy, and she knew how to turn it aside. Darren was different. For the first and only time, she'd been tempted, regardless of the consequences. He was smooth, alluring. The physical effect he'd had on her was unlike anything she'd felt with another man, even Jason. She resisted Darren, but she found herself in the grip of sexual fantasies about him for months. When he stared at her, she thought he knew exactly how she felt. Later, she'd realized that his skillful seduction was a ploy. If they'd had an affair, he could have used it against her. She was part of his plan, and she hated him for it. "No," she insisted. "I don't think it's Darren." Jason looked as if he wanted to argue with her, but they'd argued enough about Darren Newman in the past. The damage was done. "Then who?" "There's someone else," Frankie said. He came over and stood very close to her. "Who is it?" "A patient. I can't tell you who, and I can't tell the police either, not unless I know something for sure." "Why do you think it's him?" Frankie thought about Todd Ferris on the Bay Trail. "He approached me when I was running yesterday. It made me uncomfortable, like he was stalking me. He said he didn't want to come to the office because he didn't want anything in writing. In other words, he didn't want a trail of evidence. Or at least that's how I took it." Her husband's dark eyes looked even darker. "What did he say?" "He was having strange memories. He claimed to remember women being tortured. He said he came to me because he recognized one of the women from the news. It was Bryn Lansing." "This guy says he saw one of your patients being tortured." She nodded. "I didn't believe it when he talked to me. It sounded too wild, like someone was making up stories just to get attention. But now..." "If it's him, why would he come to you and admit it? Why would he play these games and then simply tell you what he was doing?" "I don't know. He could be schizophrenic, but I didn't get that sense from him in treatment." "Did he say that he was the one torturing these women?" Jason asked. "No, he said he was a witness. He saw it." "You should talk to the police about this." "Don't you think I want to?" "I can't. Unless he says or does something that lets me break privilege, my hands are tied. Then what are you going to do?" Frankie crossed the treatment room to the door that led to her office. She went behind her desk and used her keys to unlock her filing cabinet. That was where she kept all her patient records. She hunted in the second drawer and found the slim folder for Todd Ferris. "I need to reach out to him," she said. "Meet him. Talk to him." "Alone? No way. Take me with you." "I already told you that I can't break privilege. I can't let you find out who he is." Jason didn't answer, and she added, "I'm sorry." "This is the way it always is between us," he snapped. "What do you mean?" "It's you on your own, Frankie. It's never you and me." "That's not true. It's not my choice." "Of course it is. You don't need me. You don't need Pam. You don't need anybody." "Jason, do what you want," he snapped. "I'll see you at home." He turned around and stalked out of the office. The first door slammed, and then she heard the other door slam, too. She was alone again. "He's wrong," she thought. She didn't need to keep the rest of the world off her island. Or maybe she was just kidding herself. She'd learned her lessons from her father growing up. Don't ask for help. Don't need anyone else, because they won't be there for you. Frankie opened Todd Ferris's file, and found the patient information sheet that every new patient completed. Hesitating, she keyed the number of his cell phone. She tried to think about what she would tell him. When she heard the phone ringing, she held her breath. Hello? It was a woman's voice. Frankie was silent for a moment. I'm sorry, I was trying to reach Todd.
Who?
Todd Ferris?
You got the wrong number, the woman replied.
Oh, I'm sorry. Frankie rattled off the number she dialed, thinking she'd made a mistake. But the woman said, That's the number, but no Todd here. Goodbye.
Wait, sorry. Can you just tell me, did you recently acquire this phone number?
I've had it for 6 years. Now goodbye, okay? The woman on the other end of the line hung up.
Frankie stared at the patient information form. It was handwritten, not typed. Each patient filled in the details personally.
Todd Ferris had given her a fake phone number.
21. The only evidence Frost found at Christie Park's apartment in Millbrae was a ticket from a downtown parking ramp in the cup holder of her Honda Civic. It was stamped on Friday morning at 7:36 a.m. As far as Frost could tell, no one had seen Christie again until her date with Noah on Saturday night. The parking ramp was on California Street, where the financial district bled into Chinatown. The ramp attendant was a dark-skinned Filipino kid with black hair that sprouted from his head like wheatgrass. Frost guessed that he was no older than 19. His long legs were propped on the office desk as he watched the Giants on television and ate cold lumpia from a plastic container. The name tag on his shirt said Arne. Frost introduced himself, and Arne sprang to his feet.
What can I do for you, Inspector?
He dangled a plastic evidence bag in front of the kid's face. This ticket came from your ramp, right?
Arne leaned closer and studied it.
Yes, sure did.
The date stamp shows a car entering this ramp on Friday morning. The bank where the owner worked is just a couple blocks away, but she never showed up. Is there a way to look up when she left?
Sure. Come on over.
Arne rolled his wheelie chair to a flat-screen monitor and keyboard. When he nudged the mouse, the screen awakened and revealed a series of camera angles on different levels of the underground ramp. He clicked on an app that showed daily ticketing activity.
What's the number on the end of the ticket?
Arne asked. Frost rattled it off and the kid's fingers flew in the keyboard.
Here you go. In on Friday at 7:36 a.m., just like you said. She didn't stay long. Ticket stamped back out on Friday at 7:49 a.m.
Less than 15 minutes? Frost asked.
Yes, sir.
Frost frowned. Christie worked at one of the downtown branches of Wells Fargo. According to her supervisor, Christie had a client meeting scheduled in Santa Rosa on Friday afternoon, which meant driving to work that day, not taking BART as she usually did. Instead, she missed work and missed her meeting. And yet, here she was, arriving at the ramp downtown on Friday morning, and then heading back out almost immediately.
Your security cameras, Frost said. How far back do you keep the video?
A month.
Then the files get deleted automatically.
Can you pull up footage from the entry and exit camera on Friday morning?
Sure,
Arne replied. It's all web-based now. The app saves a new file for every camera every hour.
He clicked over to the archive and selected Friday from a calendar pop-up. He chose the camera focused on the main entrance and played the video file beginning at 7 a.m.
We should have her going in and out in the same file.
What time did she come in?
Just after 7:30? I'll speed it up.
Frost saw a steady stream of cars entering the ramp in fast motion. When the on-screen clock approached the time at which Christie Park entered the ramp, Arne slowed the video down to normal speed. Frost watched two more cars turn into the garage, and then, after a gap of about 90 seconds, he recognized Christie's burgundy Honda Civic and matched the license plate. The car stopped at the ticket machine, and he saw a woman's slim, bare arm reach from the window to take a ticket.
Freeze it,
Frost said.
The video motion stopped.
Can you zoom in?
A little, but this isn't high def.
Arne was right. By the time he'd enlarged the video to make out the front window, the features of the driver were unrecognizable. Even so, the woman's general look was consistent with the photographs Frost had seen of Christie Park.
Okay, keep going, Frost said.
He watched the car disappear. There was another minute-long gap before the next vehicle entered the ramp.
He waited to see a few more cars turn into the garage, and then he asked Arne to fast-forward the video to Christie's departure time. At that time of the morning, the exit lane was mostly unused. The only departing vehicle he saw was Christie's Civic, which pulled up to the payment machine at 7:49 a.m. "Maybe she forgot something," Arne suggested, and then he whistled.
"Whoa!
Freeze it," Frost said. Arne wasn't fast enough, and he had to back up the video. Then he stopped the playback, just as an arm reached from the window of the Civic to insert the ticket in the payment machine. It was the same car, Christie's car, but Christie wasn't driving. The arm they saw was covered by the sleeve of a black sweatshirt, and the hand with the ticket was protected by a surgical glove.
"That don't look like her," Arne muttered.
"No, it sure doesn't. What other cameras do you have in the ramp?"
"We've got a camera on each aisle and each floor."
"I need to see where she parked," Frost said.
"Yes, sure. Let's take a look."
Arne went back to the archives and selected a camera focused on the first aisle on the next level down. Only seconds after she arrived in the garage, Christie's Civic drove into view on the down ramp and passed a full slate of parked cars and disappeared. Arne tracked her back up the next aisle and down another level.
"There," Frost said.
The Civic pulled beyond an open parking space at the far end of the ramp, and Christie backed into the empty spot. He saw the car's headlights go dark as she turned off the engine. A few more seconds passed, and then he saw Christie Park appear, purse over her shoulder, her phone in her hand. She made the long walk from one end of the ramp to the other, getting closer to the camera. Frost waited. He knew what was going to happen. He just didn't know when. He wished he could tell her, "Don't pay attention to your phone. Pay attention to your surroundings, and walk down the middle of the aisle, not the side." But she didn't. She was preoccupied, her head down. She approached one of the concrete support columns, and that was when he grabbed her. It didn't even take 5 seconds. An arm reached out, took hold of her neck, and pulled her out of view. There was no sound in the camera, but Frost doubted that she even had time to scream. He kept watching. Christie never appeared again. Neither did her attacker. He watched another car arrive and park, and then one more. And then he saw the headlights of Christie's Civic go on again. The car pulled out. It was too dark and too far to see who was behind the wheel, and the angle of the camera was too sharp to see inside as the car drove closer. Then it was gone.
"I guess he was waiting for somebody to come along," Arne said.
No, he was waiting for her, Frost thought. He'd been studying Christie Park. He knew where she parked and when she usually arrived. Frost wondered if he'd hacked her phone to keep an eye on her calendar. A meeting in Santa Rosa meant she'd be driving. There was nothing spontaneous about this abduction. It had been planned for weeks. The same was probably true of Monica Farr and Bryn Lansing. And the fact that it had happened to Christie and Bryn so close together meant that this man was now playing his game on a fast schedule. Frost didn't think he was done. "I'm going to give you the specs for a file upload site," he told Arne. "I need you to transfer all of the camera video files for Friday morning, starting at 5 o'clock. Can you do that?"
"Sure thing. You're trying to spot when the guy got here, huh? Thing is, he may not have parked in the ramp. He could have walked in at our pedestrian entrance off California. We don't have cameras in the stairwell."
"Understood," Frost said. But he thought the safer play for this guy was to drive a stolen car into the ramp, rather than risk being spotted by one of the security or ATM cameras out on the street. The Nightbird wasn't a fool. "I'm going to write down a few other dates this month," Frost added, "and I need the morning files for those dates, too." Christie had already been to this parking garage several times this month, according to the tickets he'd found in her Civic. Maybe her stalker had been right behind her one of those days, and maybe he hadn't been so careful when he was following her. After he gave the information to Arne, Frost walked to the stairwell at the back of the ramp. He headed down 2 flights to the parking level where Christie had been abducted. The structure was well lit with overhead fluorescence, but it was still a parking garage. There were plenty of shadows, and every car afforded hiding places. He walked slowly. The ceiling was low, and he smelled exhaust and gasoline. He spotted the webcam mounted on the wall and guessed that Christie's stalker had scouted the positions of every camera on the ramp. To do that, he would have been visible, but he would also have been one person among thousands in the garage every day, a needle in a haystack. Frost counted the support call